Here, Am I terrible if I just speak at a normal volume? I'm told that the speakers in the room actually work, even though it doesn't sound like a PA system. Can people hear me, even in the back? Not at all. Roland, you're wrong. He's our AV technician, isn't he? Roland, whatever you did, thank you very much. So welcome to this, what I understand is the fifth episode of Internet and Society. For those of you on the law school side, I think it's about the 12th for those of you on the MIT side. And I feel that we could be using double sessions on the law school side as we are moving somewhat faster than a freight train. So a few preliminary announcements. First, I was thinking it would be very useful to schedule an optional review session where there would be an opportunity to ask anything that might be on your mind. Where I might have an opportunity to offer a little more stitching between the patches of the quotes we are making. And I understand that there is a time set aside for that Friday afternoon. The convenient time of Friday afternoons is kind of makeup class time. So let me just take the temperature of people here. If I were to have a session tomorrow for the purposes of just general review and filling in spaces that we left open, how many would attend? We'll say tomorrow around 2. Okay, because they have a very small room. Yeah, right. If there would be food, beer, how many would? Oh, that's not true.
You can't have that in my shape.
That's true. Forgot how young people are here. Next Friday, a week from Friday, is it time or people really don't want to do this, which I'm delighted not to spend my Friday doing it if no one else wants it either. Next Friday, a week from tomorrow at 2 o'clock, would that be a useful thing? How many people would show up for such a thing? All right, so that's enough for me. So I will schedule such a thing and let you know when and where. We'll make a recording of it so that you may hear it at your leisure later if for some reason you don't want to attend. And again, it's fully optional just to piece together some things. I think Alex is planning on doing a separate tech review session as well. And you're also going to email from me soon on some recent news developments that are tracking our class alarmingly closely. Also, we have the moot courts coming up. Michal, you are organizing that, right? Where are you? There you are. And maybe it'd be useful, because the MIT students are to have a role in that, to just say a little thing about it, including when and where it is, and do whatever recruitment you want to do right now.
Hi, I'm Michal. So Leo Gaston and I are coordinating the Consumer Conference, which takes place on November 30th, somewhere around 7:30 p.m. And it will be in the Ames courtroom, where we have a lot of the time. To start with the presentation on technology at issue in the middle of a weekend study on MIT, so that's something that Leo actually will be contacting the computer session.
And do the MIT students who are doing this know who they are yet?
They don't.
Okay, so they're not supposed to. So this would be a very interesting case, and we're looking for a general presentation from the MIT students to help frame it, and then turn it over to the lawyers to actually litigate it. So I hope there are enough MIT students interested in that to do that part. And this is Professor Hal Ibbotson. He's teaching the MIT course. So this is your first visit here, isn't it?
Yes, hi. I missed the last job session, so this is the first week I actually meet the Harvard students. And
you can see how enthusiastic they are.
Yeah, absolutely. Our rabid FBI agent, Danny Weisner, I think we'll be along meeting with that in an hour. I think he's actually at a meeting of the Web Consortium, the W3C, where they're working trying to hash out what they'd like their patent policy to be. So he might be in a mood to actually say something about that. On the other hand, he might want to keep his mouth shut when he comes here. You might want to try to ask him some hard questions about what they've been doing.
Good. We don't really have a functioning threaded messaging area aside from the names list. The which those of you who have not unsubscribed have been blessed with a deluge of mail on the names list. These are surprisingly substantive, actually. It's quite amazing. The chairman of the board of ICANN has now joined in, and it's people are issuing press releases about our list. I'll forward one to you all so you can see the news it's making outside our little world. But Hal has graciously offered to tie us into a combined thread of messaging list with the MIT students. And
right.
How will that work?
Right. So what I'm going to do is I've created a new discussion forum. I haven't quite created it. In fact, I'm about within 15 minutes of creating it, which I'll do tonight. And I'll send it to Jonathan. I guess we'll put instructions about how to register on the course webpage. And then for the MIT students, what we're going to do is we're going to keep both of them. And we'll have a place where I think normally you'll want to send things to the join list, but occasionally you may want to send things that are a little bit more private to our class, and we'll keep the old one for that. You'll see this all emerge on the class webpage tonight.
Great. And final announcement, next week, not this week, is the week that abstracts are due, and you'll be asked about them for the paper. I'll say more about that in a follow-up email. The only two words I'd advise you right now is don't panic. So don't worry about that unduly. Okay, so why don't we turn, is there anything else I need to say? Remote teaching and teach speech panel. The special project students should come see Alex after class. Okay, is there any other administrative junk that remote participation is now up again. The ashtrays have been enabled. The dean has personally approved the use of the Ethernet jacks that have been built into the room. So I'm told they're turned on, so if you've got a laptop with Ethernet, plug right in. And what URL should they go to then? Time.log.harvard.edu/is99/ask. So I see a lot of laptops. So plug in. If you're from MIT and you don't have a registered card, I think you are excluded. So unless you can hack in, which I don't endorse, but if you can, you'll take exception.
I can't resist. I got a call from the operator at the MIT Microsoft initiative. I got a call from a reporter from the Crimson, who's writing a story about this, who sort of asked me, what were we going to do, and what were we going to do interesting educational technology things, like make it so students could bring laptops to class. And I told him that in my experience, the only people who ever brought laptops to class were the Harvard Law students.
Good one for us. Okay. You made palm tops to class or something?
Yeah, we have the chip injected.
We thought we'd start today with a crash course in antitrust. So here comes a crash course in antitrust, approximately 5 minutes on the subject. There exists in the United States something known as the Sherman Antitrust Act. Wonderfully vague. It's from the days of legislation when we could make it a page or so and pass it and be done. Perhaps due to a technology that didn't enable you to rapidly proliferate text. In any case, the Sherman Antitrust Act has two basic sections. One section says there shall be no conspiracies in the strength of trade. So don't get together with people who are supposed to be your competitors and do things that kind of carve up a market between you. The classic example would be price fixing. Various milk producers get together and decide that the price of milk shall henceforth be $2 a gallon rather than $1 a gallon wholesale, and they can afford to do it if all of them are in on it, and they all make extra profit as a result. Of course, that does happen. The best done through what's known as the Milk Dairy Board, and that's approved through our government. Part of the farm subsidy program. But aside from when the government says you can, you can't. From the Antitrust Act, they say you can't get together in the classic smoke-filled room and make such agreements. It also often typically happens, a lot of the cases are centered around garbage hauling contracts. That appears to be one of the very well elaborated areas of antitrust law and the price fixing for Luna. Waiting to see if I won something. The second area of the Sherman Antitrust Act that is perhaps more relevant to us for talking about the Microsoft case today has to do with monopolization. are somehow abusing monopoly power. And the first thing to notice about that is that really having a monopoly is not the problem. If you just happen to have a monopoly in something, you're not immediately alone with that in contravention of the antitrust laws here. There are parallel sets of laws around the world, indeed DG4, I think it is, over in the European Commission, has an active interest in antitrust issues and has been following Microsoft in this way as well. What is a monopoly? A monopoly is first thought of as undue market power, control over a market, as evidenced perhaps by massive market share. So if you have 85-90% market share, when people want a given product or service in the relevant area, and 85-90% of them are turning to you for it, that may be a good sign that there is a monopoly present. As you can see, it's not determinative. It's a kind of weird, slippery test. Perhaps more important than just market share is asking the question, is it contestable market share? Does this one company have so much market power just because they happen to be doing it best? They're just so wildly popular that they just haven't been beating everybody else out. But if somebody better were to come along, immediately that market share would decrease. It's contested. Or is there some reason why we think it's not a contestable market? So let's say a monopoly, you may say, well, why are monopolies bad? What makes a monopoly prone to doing bad things? Well, for one thing, the monopolists are lazy. Because they've got a monopoly, they don't have to worry about competition. For some reason, it's not a contestable market. And as a result, they're just lazy. They don't innovate. They're not pushed by competition to do new things. So you get bad service. You get surly service. All the sorts of things you come to expect, for instance, when you try to buy a hot dog at a stadium. If there's nowhere else to go to get your hot dog, they actually strip you of hot dogs on the way into the stadium or into a movie theater to guarantee that the only hot dogs you will eat will be from the surly, poor service establishment within the stadium. So that's an example of just generally not being very innovative. Some people may say that the heart has those characteristics too. I will not weigh in on that. Or the MIT Student Center. Second is price gouging. You can just raise your price. If people have nowhere else to go for the product or service in question, you can charge them more. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to charge them an infinite amount for the service. There is only so much the market may bear. But what you'll charge will be different than what you would charge in a competitive environment. Whatever difference there exists in what people are willing to pay and what you'd be willing to accept for it, in a monopoly environment, you're much more likely to get closer to what people are willing to pay rather than what you are willing to accept. So the consumer surplus ends up in the hands of the manufacturers. Another feature the monopolists can do is some form of abuse. They can try to, for instance, abusively maintain their monopoly. So for example, if there were one general milk producer in the area, and suddenly a new one was coming into town, a new dairy has been set up, you might imagine the supermarket saying, okay, I'll stock a third of my shelves with the new brand. You can imagine the old monopolist saying, you have to, if you're going to take any milk from us, agree that all of your shelves will have our milk, or you'll have none at all. And you can imagine that given how new and uncertain the new product is, the grocery stores would cave in to that demand from monopolists. That might represent an abuse of monopoly power for the purpose of maintaining it. We have a number of licenses at issue in the Microsoft case that we might get into in the first Microsoft case that actually bear on that. And finally, there's the worry that even if you don't have a monopoly, you may unlawfully try to obtain one. One way you might try to do it is through predatory pricing. You could try to lower your price really low such that competitors just can't compete. And indeed, while you're doing it, you're hemorrhaging money as well, but you've built up a war chest of some kind to take it. Once the other people go belly up, you can then raise your prices as high as need be to recoup your losses in the predatory phase. There's actually a dispute in antitrust circles as to how big a problem predatory pricing is. Figuring that since you always have to raise your money to recoup, you have to raise the price, as soon as you do that, won't people flow back in and compete with you? I suppose there was a provision of jet service somewhere, it may be hard to scramble some jets and create a new company to compete with somebody who has aced out every other airline in a given hub, but there are other instances, perhaps the provision of milk, where it might be a little bit easier. So that's, I guess, monopolization in 5 minutes or so. But realize that a lot of what's been talked about in the Microsoft case is not this conspiracy stuff, but instead undue monopolization, and then the task has been for the Justice Department to put the finger on bad behavior of some kind that amounts to a problem under the Act and for which some remedy, be it a fine or something stronger, is required. So I thought that actually, Dennis, in the Microsoft case, it would be useful to have a little bit of role play. I've asked Benjamin Edelman to take on a role that is anathema to pretty much everything he stands for, which is the role of David Boies, lawyer for the Justice Department, actually prosecuting the case. And Hal Abelson has agreed to do something which I don't know if it's fair to say it would be anathema to everything you stand for, anathema to most things you stand for, and take on the role of defending Microsoft. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, great. So, Ben, let me ask you first, what's the big problem here? Why is Microsoft such a threat?
I thought I had about 10 minutes to answer that rather than the let me ask you first kind of
You're already being argumentative.
And yet,
why don't you take as long as you can to me, and I'll cut you off if I think you're getting it wrong.
Well, very well, and I'll even take the liberty of calling some witnesses as suggested.
Okay.
So many of us have computers, some of us sitting around this room, we can have them out and connected to the net. And as we look at our computers, no doubt we realize that they're, surprise, mostly running Windows. And you get Windows from a particular company, a company that has market power, as economists might like to say. And there are all kinds of details to be worked out. What is the relevant market? What kind of power do they have? How much power do they have? But intuitively, I think we all know that we're dependent on Microsoft in a certain sense. If they were to refuse to sell any more copies of Windows tomorrow, it would be a problem for some of us as we moved to something else, especially if we were prohibited from copying our existing copies. If they did something to Windows that we all found especially annoying, they added a particular wizard that pops up at an unfortunate time, there would be little we could do about it. Basically, you'd have to learn how to fix your copy of Windows or all of your copies of Windows if you were lucky enough to have multiple computers, each of which had to be fixed independently. And they could pretty much get away with it. That, to me as an economist, sounds an awful lot like market power. And so, given the importance of software running on personal computers to our economy, we might be concerned that one company has market power and potentially at least the ability to do, say, whatever it wants. I'll call it my first witness, a representative of Dell Computers in their OEM software division, a person who is involved with deciding what kind of software Dell will preload.
Please. Who's our first witness? Am I supposed to designate them?
You're supposed to designate
them. I'm supposed to designate our first witness.
We could even get the cold call database up, or we
I don't like the open rebellion where I had to do that. Why don't I call on Alex McGillivray? Alex, he's prepared to be sworn in as a representative of Dell Computer. You are duly sworn.
It's kind of
loose procedure here.
Okay. Go ahead. So, Alex, here you are. You sit behind your desk at Dell all day. You stand, as the case may be. Customers call Dell and want to buy computers. You sell them to them, most of the time at least, when the product that you're selling more or less meets their desires. When you're selling what they want, the sale goes through, and when you're not, presumably it doesn't. In your experience, what would you say most customers want in terms of operating system software? And do you perceive there to be any sort of like a network effect, shall we say, for those who've done the reading?
Yeah, we at Dell recommend that Dell has a whole bunch of applications. So yeah, I would say there's more effect. And also, you know, that would be in the application mode. Dell would recommend Windows because we know that we can also sell Microsoft Office and a whole bunch of other applications. So along with the suggestion we're running, we can use the app.
So that all sounds like supply-side externalities, you might call it, supply-side network effects, where you, Dell, as a supplier, find it better to sell me a more expensive product, the way the used car dealer might want to sell me, all other things being equal, the more expensive used car rather than the cheaper one.
Which you make protection with the windows.
But there's another side to it, I think, that you've started to allude to, that once consumers are used to Windows, more consumers want more Windows. If everyone else has Windows, you're better off being like them, so you can walk up to their computer and use their software and so on. You perceive all of that in your vast experience as a Dell OEM relations.
This is called leading the witness.
I've got a lot to learn.
Yeah, what you're getting at is that I want to sell a person Windows machines that they're comfortable using Windows machines. Because when they call me up, they talk Windows machines. They want a computer, but when I'm talking about it, to be home for that thing, I know that they're talking about Windows machines.
And so, Alex, if I can ask you just to take off your hat, you needn't put on another one, because you might not have brought another one with you, but so closely related is the following role of the independent software developer. You're now the independent software developer. You've been sworn in by our lengthy procedure. You're developing software. You make money for every item you sell. You sell to the mass market. You're writing, say, graphic software, something that Microsoft doesn't make or doesn't make very much of. And you have to write what kind of software and why.
Here's your question. It's kind of a hard time to play. Go back a while before the internet and all the rest of it. And then I'm writing operating software, and then I want to write the data problem. That data problem is Microsoft. So the first place I want to use my software is going to be for Microsoft, whatever the most current operating system is, Microsoft, that's what I want to write.
That sounds right, and now you're leading me, but you're leading me in just the way I want to be going. There's a company called Netscape. Some of you may have heard of it.
Are you done with it?
I'm quite done.
But let me ask a few questions, and then you pick up the Netscape, okay? Two more questions to flesh out the beginnings of the Microsoft case, because it turns out there have been several Microsoft cases in quick succession. Dell is an OEM, an original equipment manufacturer. That means you take computers and you ship them out the door to people who buy them, right? Now, do you ever ship bare computers, computers that have a hard drive ready to have software and operating systems put on them? Why not? And that's stipulated by contract. How interesting. Well, this is a state of affairs that was true. Whose side are you on? Close enough. So there's a contract, right? Dell is kind of a supermarket. Microsoft's got the milk. And Dell says, if I ship computers out my door that are devoid of any operating system, I'm shipping doorstops. I'm not shipping anything useful anymore. People generally want Windows. So they've got to go to Microsoft and get a license to take Windows, put it on the machine, and then the machine goes out the door. But these licenses have some strange terms, some of which, for example, to be exact, in the past, included a term that said, if you want to ship any computers out the door with the Dell name on it and with Microsoft Windows installed, every single computer you ship has to pay for Windows. Maybe you don't have to install it, but you've got to pay for it for each one. The per processor license is how we're going to run it. So you've got to account us as to how many computers are going out the door, and that's how many copies of Windows you're buying. Is that right?
Yes,
it is. So that was part of the grounds of the first case against Microsoft, saying, wait a minute, so if maybe three people, however odd they were, wanted their machines without Windows on it, with OS 2 or some other operating system, Dell would be hard-pressed to give it to them, because the structure of their agreement with Microsoft has them having to buy Windows and pass along the cost of Windows, if that's how they want to do it, for every computer they ship. And that was alleged to be an anti-competitive monopolization, preventing somebody from entering the market who otherwise might. I know this is an odd cross-examination, but you're doing very well. Now that was settled. There was a consent decree settling many of the issues that had to do with that. All of these issues arose from contracts between Microsoft and these OEMs. That was the primary thrust of the case against them, and it was settled. And the settlement actually went before Judge Skorkin, as these things in a Cunning Act proceeding have to do. The judge is supposed to say, I bless you all, in a proceeding about as formal as the one you've been witnessing here. Oddly, Judge Skorkin, Sporky as he's known, some on the bench, refused to do that. He actually wrote a book called Hard Drive with all sorts of allegations about Microsoft's behavior. He was so obsessed with it, he raised his questions during the Cunning Act proceeding. Neither side was particularly briefed on the issue of this book, which had not been entered into evidence. And he refused to say that this was a good deal. So he said, I'm going to send you both back to do your homework. So then you ended up with an odd appeal of his decision from both sides, with him sort of as a defendant, kind of interesting procedure, up to the D.C. Circuit. And the D.C. Circuit says, Judge Borkin, you've overstepped. You should have approved it. It passes enough of a smell test that it's okay. But in fact, they remanded the case back to the D.C. District to do some extra paperwork on it, to finish it off, to a different judge. A very kind of classic slap in the face to the original judge who had it. Now they're remanding it to him to do it, but instead saying to somebody differently. In this case, Thomas Penfield Jackson, who has the newest Microsoft case as well. Now, I don't know if it's worth it to get into the contempt proceeding right now. Do you want to start with your next case sentence, or should I go over the contempt proceeding? So I'm going to tell you quickly about the contempt proceeding. Here's the contempt proceeding. At some point, there was a decree, and the decree set to last for a number of years, and the decree had Microsoft agreeing it would stop practices like this. And basically, the idea was it's not going to condition the acceptance of a license for one piece of operating software on the acceptance of some other license, be it for another computer. So if you want one, you've got to buy 100. Or perhaps for a different kind of operating system. In this case, it was a very obscure battle where they were bundling DOS with Windows, and there were alternatives to DOS that could potentially be bundled with Windows, and Microsoft wanted to make sure Microsoft DOS was the one that got bundled with Windows and was requiring acceptance of that second license. So they agreed not to do that anymore, thus making the world free for competitive DOS alternatives as part of this proceeding. The contempt then came to light. The contempt proceeding was brought when Microsoft was requiring that the browser be shipped with the operating system. There's this Internet Explorer browser that's competing with Netscape, and Microsoft says to Dell, you can't have Windows unless you take Internet Explorer with it. And you know what? Once you take it, you can't take it away. It's got to leave your factory with Internet Explorer on the machine. And then people are free to install Netscape. In fact, you can install Netscape if you want. You are not free to take off IE. And this was thought of perhaps as an inappropriate tying of one product to another. And back to the crash course on antitrust, tying is when if you have a monopoly in one market, you try to achieve a monopoly in another market by bundling things together. Everybody needs your milk. The only way you can buy milk is with oranges strapped to it. And thus, other orange producers are going to find a lot less interest in their products than the only so many oranges every day, and it's coming with the milk. And similarly, here comes the browser in that fashion. So that was the contempt proceeding that went to Judge Jackson. Judge Jackson was finding, it seemed, in direction against Microsoft. He actually enlisted the help of Larry Lessig, the special master in the case. Microsoft appealed on a raft of preliminary issues, and the D.C. Circuit said that this was not an appropriate case for special master, for any special master, so they're not Larry, and also reversed Judge Jackson on many of the injunction issues about the time. So, back to that case.
That's half the story of Netscape already, what Microsoft did in response, or at least the first part of what Microsoft did in response. But you might ask why Microsoft cares. I mean, after all, it's only a tiny startup company. There are thousands of those writing software for Windows. What made Netscape different? What got Microsoft's attention? And for that, I'm actually going to call not someone from Netscape, landscape, but someone from Sun, if I can.
Presuming that we're given one chance to speak, I'd like to recognize Alex McGillivray as our Sun representative.
All right.
You
never have to talk if you're not really in the classroom. So Netscape by version 2 of Navigator, as I recall, had not only what you might call standard page rendering technologies, where it could take a piece of HTML code transmitted from a web server and display it in its graphical browser, the first graphical browser to attain common acceptance on the PC platform at least, but it had added something else from your company, Sun. Perhaps you'd like to tell us about that was a cutting edge phenomenon. It's true. I'm referring to Java, actually. And so tell me about Java.
Java is a platform as far as the program are concerned, the layer between the computer that's being run on the CPU and the operating system is also a browser, like the Navigator, and then we're running Java as well. And then the program will sit on top of Java and allow for them to be run on the CPU.
And what's the significance of that, really?
Our best model for running anywhere. The idea being that you would, as a developer, who's just writing Java, and then some or other people on Netscape would take care of making it so that the Java part would hook up with the browser or the system that it would be run on. So as a developer, I would no longer have to care what operating system I'm writing for. I'm just writing for Java.
And so that's very convenient for Sun selling products to developers. It's even more convenient potentially for users. If you're a user that decides actually you'd rather not have Windows, you have some other computing device, maybe a web TV or the thing on the front of your refrigerator that can run Java as it turns out, you could access an application written in Java from whatever network terminal type device you happen to have that was Java compliant, could you not?
Yes.
And so then there would be much less of a stigma attached to using alternative computing platforms. Instead of Windows, you could in fact use something else so long as it had Java.
Yeah, all you would need is to have all these Java applications and other, let's say, the Windows Java applications would be someone who writes a Java box or
and so here we see why Java is in a sense different than the other technologies that Microsoft might be said to have stampeded over the years. They've steamrolled lots of companies, but none had ever presented a cross-platform computing vision, one in which there would really be potential competition with the operating system. And it's for that I, as the Department of Justice, became so concerned when I saw what Microsoft was doing with its contracts with companies like Dell, in particular taking steps to make it less attractive to consumers to use Netscape. In particular, you can be Dell again for a second now. Identity crisis. As Jonathan said, you, Dell, would be prohibited from removing Internet Explorer. You could install Netscape also. But is it fair to say that Microsoft took certain steps that would make you less inclined to install Netscape?
They made it so that I had to install
Well, it's only software. Why not install every piece of software under the sun, at least every piece of free software under the sun, on every new computer you ship out from the Dell Corporation? More programs, more happiness for your users, more sales, no?
More happiness for me and Dell. It's also more happiness for the consumer because Microsoft wants to
So in short, what Microsoft required through contract or with licenses with OEMs was that you, Dell, and in fact all other major OEMs that had certain kinds of bulk licensing agreements, namely all the companies you've ever heard of that sell computers, they all had to take Internet Explorer as the tied product connected to the tying product Windows, and that had quite a serious impact on Netscape's ability to conduct business. We won't make you be Netscape, but I'll just say that if it's true, Netscape's sales plummeted. They were forced to give away Netscape Navigator for free. Without revenue, it became harder to keep their developers on staff, working hard, thinking about stock options. And in essence, it destroyed the company, one might allege, just because Microsoft, through contract, through its market power with the OEMs, was able to, in essence, destroy Netscape's momentum.
Okay, so that's a pretty good story for Mr. Boyce. And it explains why, while there might be a tying case to be made with Solitaire, after all, Solitaire software is bundled with every version of Windows I've ever seen, and if you were thinking of going into the, I don't know, gaming for one market as a software developer, you might do well not to do Solitaire as something you want to sell people, since everybody already has it. And I can imagine that actually a significant portion of Dell's support calls with people saying, I keep losing in Solitaire, can you fix it? There's that, but this is a level beyond Solitaire. This isn't just about a monopoly maybe in the new one-player gaming market, or even a monopoly in the browser market, whatever that is. But rather, a way in which the browser market, because the browser had bundled Java with it, was actually the way to control Java. And if you could control Java, you could neutralize this threat back to your original monopoly that was emerging from this write once, run anywhere paradigm that it offered. So with that, why don't I let all these libels that have been said about Microsoft be neutralized by Mr. Abelson, who I guess maybe in the person of Steve Ballmer or something like that, able to express what's wrong with all this.
Got a short sum here, of course. Microsoft is one of the most successful companies in history. And it's successful because it's managed to latch on to this phenomenon of the information revolution, and to a large extent, it has helped create that. If you go think back to the difference between now and 15 years from now, when computers were much, much harder to use, when they were not so nearly widespread, where there was tremendous fragmentation of standards. And you see the difference that's been made by the fierce competition of companies such as Microsoft. You can begin to appreciate the benefit to the public of having the ability to control standards and move very, very fast. Because one of the things that you know is that in the world of the Internet, development must move extremely fast. Those of you who have been watching Microsoft for, say, the last even 5 years, you saw that entire company turn around from the point where they didn't even recognize that there was an Internet to a point where they're the dominant force in that. And the only reason that you can do that is when you have a clear, consistent technical vision and you are given the opportunity to compete. The other thing that you see, that you know, is that the world of competition in information technology is extremely vicious, and you see a lot of companies who go out with let's say flawed or ridiculous business plans, expecting to make it in the world of the Internet, and finding that they have a convenient scapegoat when their ridiculous business plans fail. So it's very easy to go blame Microsoft simply because you are not as innovative and not as as technically capable and not as single-minded. To quote Microsoft, actually, the antitrust laws are not a prescription for civility in business, unquote. And you have, yes, the antitrust laws are not about you should be nice to your competitors, and they're not about you should always even necessarily bend over backwards to play fair. And Microsoft has been a very, very fierce, single-minded competitor. So like the Microsoft case where you notice the government was able to call expert witnesses from a variety of backgrounds, Microsoft turned out to find only one outside organization that would supply expert witnesses, and that was MIT. So I think we'll do the same thing here. And you just recently did a deal with Microsoft, is that right?
Yes,
$25 million. Yes, we just did a $25 million deal with Microsoft.
That's great. I read a wonderful coincidence.
absolute coincidence. Yeah. As is the Gates Computer Science Building.
Hey, right by the door, right next door.
Absolute coincidence. So I'd like to call Jeff Sheldon, who is a knowledgeable computer science student from MIT, and I'd like to ask you, what software do you run on your computer? Windows NT. Are you able to use non-Microsoft applications on Windows NT? Why? Do you ever use Linux?
Yes.
Are you able to use Linux software on your machine?
Yes, I am.
Why?
Because in another computer, you created a
special
program,
which actually allows you to run Linux without the Linux. So, do you use a word processor?
Yes,
you can. What's your favorite word
processor?
Why? So when the Justice Department comes in and says the fact that Microsoft sells this operating system called Windows forces all of these poor people to use Word and use Excel and use Internet Explorer and all these things, are you forced to use Word because you're running Windows?
Absolutely not.
Well, what do you think of this argument that people are locked in? Is it that only MIT computer science expert students who can choose to use Windows and none of the Microsoft applications? Why do you think Microsoft? Let me ask some other experts from MIT. How many people use Microsoft Word from MIT? Okay. So why? I mean, you found out that you don't have to. Why do you use Microsoft Word rather than running VMware and either Word Processor or Emacs or something? Why do you use Microsoft Word? You're the expert. You like the interface?
You know, call it disaster and
this is also possibly disastrous.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's when you like it because it's seamlessly integrated. Okay.
Bonus question for the law student. Is that a statement on which one can prosecute?
Get back to me on that.
Okay, so let's take that to this part, which I think is, which you said is a disaster, but actually is really the issue. Microsoft doesn't make operating systems in its view. It makes platforms. And platform is that integrated thing. And while the Justice Department may think this is some terrible, evil thing because somebody can play with words, and so you can split the browser from the word processor, from the operating system, what Microsoft discovered is that people want that because it has functionality. And the argument by the Justice Department that this is some evil design to increase their market share is simply what Microsoft has to do in order to evolve these platforms to compete. Let me call another expert witness. Maybe I'll call someone from Sun. Let's see, who here can be on our side from Sun? No? Josh. Okay, so Josh, you're at Sun and you just bought this company that's making something called Star Office. Right? Can you say a little bit about what Star Office is?
Star Office is a competitor with Microsoft Office. It's an integrated that suite of office tools, word processor, spreadsheet, etc. That's for example. And it's implemented in Java entirely. And I release the model of uses that you download the program. Inside your Java platform and store the program back to some service provider that you pay.
Right, and also there's a version that runs standalone on your desktop.
Okay, and thus you can basically access your documents from any network workstation anywhere on the internet as if it was the one that was on desktop.
And it's an integrated platform that includes spreadsheet and mailer and internet browser editor and word editor, and happens to look very, very similar to Excel and Word and things like that. Would you get fair enough?
Sure.
What's the cost of Star Office?
Free.
Free?
I believe it's free, but it's ready to use for
The desktop version is free. And the other one hasn't been released yet, so we don't know what the pricing model is. So there's this company, Sun, that is a fierce competitor to Java, to Microsoft, that is saying they're using predatory pricing, that's saying they are dominating the world by making integrated platforms that lock people in. And it just happens to be releasing. Is it fair to say that Star Office is a clone of Windows? Would you describe it that way? Very similar?
It's similar.
For those of you who have been looking at Copper, would you say virtually identical versus substantially similar?
It fills many of the same offices.
Has many of the same menus, same functionalities, and happens to be being distributed for free. Now, is this predatory pricing? Or is this just tough competition to Microsoft? So your position is that so your argument is that Microsoft should be prevented from competing in the ways that even its large competitors can compete with it.
I don't know what to say. I just had that exactly that same conversation with someone from Microsoft on the other side. You gave the answer I gave, and I gave the answer that they gave. End of parentheses. Let's see. So let's talk about this browser thing. Is there someone here from, is it AOL these days? Sun? Netscape? So Alex, you want to be one of the founders of Netscape?
Could you explain? This is the Mikey character here.
So Netscape's complaint is that it was driven out of business by now this evil network, Mr. Dallas would tell us that. And Netscape failed because Microsoft distributed a browser for free and forced Netscape to distribute a browser for free. What was Netscape's plan for being successful? Why did Netscape expect to become a successful company?
Well, our original plan to get our browser away for free.
So the argument is that Microsoft, by giving away Internet Explorer for free, forced Netscape to give away which browser for free, which was its original business plan anyway, and that's why Netscape fell.
Well, as companies we changed our minds and changed our business plan, we decided to give it away for free to Netscape one institution that we would charge for a company that would pay for it, and we would commit to the profit enterprise to have all these companies paying for their browsers.
Are there lots of companies that charge for browsers these days? Or had plans to charge for browsers? Do you know?
No, not that.
Okay. Okay, so one more witness. I need an expert witness. Let's see. I need an expert witness who works for 3Palm and makes Palm pilots. Karen, you do this? No? You can't have Alex represent every company. You have Josh? No? Okay. Okay. So you're at MIT and you also have just gone to work for 3Palm. Could you tell us a little bit about the Palm Pilot? What do people generally mean when they talk about the post-PC era? Do you know that?
When they talk about the post-PC era, they're talking about essentially ubiquitous computing, so that computers are active agents instead of independent entities. People can interact with a network, a system as a whole, instead of just a personal computer. And a Palm Pilot is an extension of that because you carry it with you, and it brings the network to you wherever you are, even if you're not at your desk.
And do you think that's going to be a big change in the way people use these computers over, say, the next 10 years?
Absolutely.
Do you think 10 years from now people are going to be sitting typing at Microsoft Word and using Internet Explorer as much as they are?
I think there will be future versions of things similar to Microsoft Word and Internet Explorer. I mean, they may not be exactly those products, but still the functionality that those products give us will still be needed. People still need to create text documents and still need to connect to the Internet.
Do you know what operating system's in the Palm Pilot?
It's a custom operating system written by Palm.
What's called?
Palm OS.
Right, and there's a whole consortium of companies that are developing stuff on that operating system.
Right.
Do you know what some of them are?
Josh, yeah. So would you say in this world of post-PC internet, would you say there are room for all sorts of new programs and services that are, right, there are people locked out from working in that world by Microsoft? There are companies that are trying to play in that area,
and actually Microsoft is one of them with the Windows CE operating system version, and as it happens, Microsoft is being locked out from that market. Microsoft was not able to leverage a monopoly in it because Palm invented the market of Palm Top Computing.
Despite the fact that they might have put Internet Explorer browser in it,
right.
So would you say that the opportunities to innovate in the software field have dried up because of Microsoft?
Some of the opportunities to innovate because connectivity is so important. One of the major promises that Palm Computing provides is that they are really interconnectable with each other. They have IRDA ports that let you exchange information back and forth. But it doesn't work if you're going to someone. You know, if you have a Palm and I'm trying to connect to you with a Windows CE device.
Josh, so the answer is, just to sum up, if you really look at the world, right, one of the things that you've learned is that the world moves a lot more slowly than technology. And the Justice Department is trapped in this funny fantasy of what the opportunities in software are and what the effect of Microsoft is, that's based on some freeze frame image of the industry that was taken in 1995 or 96. And even in the time that this case is being litigated, you're already seeing a major revolution in infrastructure. And the opportunities in that, if anything, are going to be larger than the opportunities to innovate over the last 10 years simply because increasing connectivity of the Internet. And despite the sort of argument we just had, to go to a company like Microsoft and say, well, you're a monopoly, and you're not even allowed to compete in that new world. Right? So you, because you are a monopoly, people are beating on you because you have a low price for Windows and Explorer. But when a company like Sun now actually fulfills the strategy and comes out with a free clone of your basic product, well, you're still not allowed to compete.
So, let me try to rephrase that. So what you're saying is that the Department of Justice can't bring antitrust suits against you because the anti-competitive practices that you get are killing Netscape. Because by the time they get the suit done, you're already off onto the next market killing the next potential competitor.
Or someone's killing you. Right? The argument...
So therefore you get a free pass on that.
The argument of the Justice Department is that there is no room for people to enter the field. The argument of the Justice Department is not that it's bad to have some, that it's per se bad to have some monopoly, right? As Jonathan said, it's not per se bad to be a monopoly. What's bad is that you kill off opportunities in the field by exercising your monopoly power. And I think if you look around in the world, you see that's just obviously false.
I want to give you maybe a minute or two to respond, and then before we move to our next phase, open it up to questions from anybody that wants to ask them to help sort out in your own minds as you're sort of thinking this through what you figure on the merits of this case. But go ahead with just a minute or two.
Do anything of any value in the computer software industry. It's
bad, but it's not that bad, thankfully. If it were that bad, I guess we would have already won. The proceeding wouldn't take so long. It seems to me that the problems that I might have established earlier that the real Justice Department seeks to establish in its real testimony, if you look on the Cyber MSDOJ site, there's a lot of good stuff there. There are serious problems that should be investigated and can't be waved off by saying, but look, there's this other kind of computer, a Palm Pilot that we have. You know, some millions of Palm Pilots have shipped, my God, when there are hundreds of millions of PCs running Windows out there. It's nice to see that there's competition in some aspect of computing software generally, but that doesn't mean that there's nothing bad going on. And the existence of competition there doesn't mean that the personal computer operating system market is working properly.
Okay, so while Ben sees that there are any remote comments, are there questions? Questions? Yes.
Microsoft.
I can try. That's hard enough.
You started off by characterizing making a case for why Microsoft is good for America in that, or across the world, in that you made sort of a platform that other people could work off of and brought together with the CRM80s or whatever the lots of different computers in the 1980s were. But the reason that I use Microsoft Word is actually because it's such a pain in the neck to convert files from different places. And so many people use Microsoft Word. And I have Microsoft Word perfectly because I preferred it and extracted it in order to use Word. Why do you make it so difficult to convert those dark footnotes or other things if you're including kind of making the world all nice and connected?
Sounds like a shirt where I talk about open software, which we're on the panel, which we're going to have. I think the Microsoft answer is going to be something like, in order to innovate quickly, you need to have control of those interfaces. So, yes, I could make something, and every time I go and release a new feature in Word that has a table with curved edges or something, that requires a change to the interface, I could go through some extremely slow, long process where I'm careful to document things and publish them and make sure that that my friends at Sun can immediately clone Star Office to handle that. That would slow me down. And maybe I'd even like to do that. Maybe I would like to compete to have the software compete on its merits, but I think what you find Microsoft really say is that the pace of innovation does not allow them to do that. And then so what you see as a user is that the conversion's hard, but in fact, Star Office can read Microsoft formats. And it can write its own formats that Microsoft can read, which will have the same effect. It can also write Microsoft formats. So people can play the same game with Microsoft that Microsoft's playing.
Anyone want to add to that?
You can imagine being in the automobile design business. I hate to go to the car analogy, but it works so well for so many things. So we all know about carburetors. Your carburetor, if I'm correct, and I don't really know much about how cars work, but I think it connects by a pipe that goes more or less along the bottom side of your car. And so long as all of the pipes have generally the same diameter, you could put a different carburetor in that particular place.
Air intake.
You could put a carburetor of your choice there and it would work properly. On the other hand, if you think of a system that's more deeply integrated into the way your car works, say the cooling system for your engine is connected to every part of the engine. It's connected to the heating system because it conveniently also generates the heat that keeps you warm in the winter. It's connected to the crankshaft because it needs to get its energy from somewhere. I don't know. It's connected every which way. And the fact is that to put a Ford signaling system in a GM engine is just going to be hard work. So similarly, although a footnote in Word looks to you like a footnote in WordPerfect, from the point of view of a team of busy programmers who will probably readily admit that their code is spaghetti, certainly, and Netscape coders have said that, and the NT coders on occasion have even admitted that NT isn't as well designed as they might like. It's hard work to get things converted from one place to another. MIT computer science students no doubt are great at it, but in my own coding escapades, I've found it difficult sometimes. You get boxed into a corner, and as much as you might like to make it work better, you know, when the choice is that or go to sleep, sometimes you choose to go to sleep.
In the corner, yes.
Yeah, how would you say that Microsoft Mario, you started off by demonstrating that consumers actually do have a choice in terms of what programs they use. How would you say, why you move from that to pointing out that there's real competition in Chicago that is not around the internet, that is the opposed to the world of Mario? Because it seems to me any monopolist will always make that, when challenge will always make the assertion that things aren't really that bad, but there's something. I was sort of wondering.
The answer
is this, I think, a real one and a sincere one. It's a question about whether this really is an entrenched monopoly. And it's certainly true that if you define the field of competition to be things exactly like, you know, Word and Windows and exactly like desktop software, then in fact Microsoft has a tremendously, tremendously strong position. But if you look at, you know, the wider world of competition, it's not that there's some other random thing called wireless. It's that a lot of the functionality that people are today getting out of desktop computers is going to be turned completely upside down by a totally new architecture. So Microsoft, in that respect, doesn't have such an entrenched, really dominant position because technology is changing, technology itself is changing and is going to overthrow that position. And I think that's a sincere answer, and that's part of the reason why they say get off our backs and let us evolve and compete.
Of course, part of what the Justice Department may say to that is, great, you've tilted the playing field, and your argument is people can still win. You know, it's not tilted vertically. They may yet make a long bomb and get the victory against us. And then the question is, how worried are you when you have the tilt in the field that it isn't dispositive? Kind of harmless error analysis that says, Netscape is so incompetent, they're going to lose it anyway, so we just kind of put them out of their misery a little sooner. Yes?
Discussing the browser field, you said that the reason why Internet Explorer, that Microsoft being that way, should be considered such a negative aspect of Microsoft, one, because of the functionality arguments, it works well with Windows, and secondly, you say it's kind of other browser companies, such as Netscape, were giving their browsers away. My question to you is, why do you then, if that's the case, force OEMs to install rather than giving it to consumers for free? And the whole question about the price is at the level where it's done. I mean, even if you suggest that kids can have it away for free, it's fine. You require that people like that put on their computers, which essentially forces a consumer's hand, because the consumer isn't going to go out, even if it's for free, and learn that.
Because the answer is, if you want to make integrated functionality that requires that, and your OEMs don't install it, they're not going to blame your OEMs. They're going to blame you. So if you're going to use, what was the example from the case, the HTML parser. and somebody goes in Word and wants to use the HTML parser, and it's not there because Dell didn't install it. They don't say that's good. Dell's bad. They come and blame you for making a product that doesn't work. And Microsoft says we want to put out the whole thing. And we have the right, we have just as much right to say you have to put in a browser as we say you have the right to put in delete Word when you click on a Word and press Redout. It's all trying to make a package that works smoothly together.
I'm just curious of what you're saying, that the people at Dell who, when they open up the software that they get from Microsoft, they download, have a bit of Internet Explorer, they download it onto their computer somehow, that creates more functionality than if I was just to get it myself and click the same, put the same key in my disk drive, and I was to download it myself.
It's a question of convenience for the user. I can sell you a thing and say you have to go through these 20 steps to put it together, or I can guarantee that when you buy it out of the box, right, from a place like Dell, it all works.
And you have to get the consumer rather than you, because you're the one making the decision. If I want to put on that manufacturer, I can turn it off. I don't have to do it. Or I can just leave it off if I'm going to put on that thing.
But that's the product I choose to sell. And if you're sitting there on the support desk, you know you're going to spend all your time with some loser who installed the thing incorrectly and still blames you.
Now, this was the argument raised by Microsoft in defense of its contracts requiring companies like Dell to bundle the stuff on come hell or high water. That case was largely mooted after the appeals court reversed the original injunction from Judge Jackson and hinted very strongly that so long as there was some colorable benefit to the consumer, enough of the kind that Hal just described, even if it has other anti-competitive effects, we're willing to let it go because we want to see a world in which the stuff gets bundled if it should be bundled. Even though you could say, well, wait, you could just offer bundles an alternative and Dell will start accepting them on its own if they're really so hot. This indeed, this whole argument has been somewhat mooted by the concept of technological tying. Actually wiring Internet Explorer so tightly into the operating system so that you couldn't take it out even if you wanted to. And at that point, you don't need the contract as law anymore. You've got the code as the law. And Dell has to hire a hacker instead of a lawyer to try to figure out how to undo that connection. Yeah.
I want to address the similarity between the
I'm not sure I understood the point, right? I mean, you're licensing this product from Microsoft, right? And there are all sorts of restrictions on what you can do.
Right.
It does highlight the fact that software today is licensed. When you buy it, you don't get it in fee-simple the way you get a chair when you buy a chair. That the conceit we engage in is that there's actually a licensing scheme, that the act of opening up the package, or the most recent agreement, I understand it's an air wrap agreement, if you breathe the same molecule as was breathed by the president of the company, you've agreed to the terms of the license. But there's something as simple as opening up the package that contains the CD-ROM, you have bound yourself to the terms of a license. That may have terms, in fact, for a while, Windows NT, I believe, had a term of its license. to the consumer that said, you agreed not to release benchmarking results, which are results that happen when you test the software and kind of put it through its paces. And Microsoft says, you agree, by accepting the software, you won't publish such results for the punitive reason of you're going to screw it up and then you're going to report bad things about it because you got it wrong, for maybe the reason that they didn't want benchmarking results to be released. That's an example of particularly bizarre, onerous, and possibly contrary to the First Amendment, bonus question for law students, contrary to the First Amendment, state action, good question, term of the license, but the other term certainly can govern your use of the software and go beyond what the default copyright, which would govern it just a simple intellectual property, would entail. And you might say that there could be something called copyright misuse or license misuse, where through your license, you're somehow maintaining the monopoly in an unlawful way.
One of the problems that one of the things that people consuming is consumer knowledge. You're consuming it, first of all, like everybody that buys this computer is going to know about different browsers. They're going to know, you know, is going to know about different browsers, is going to want to take the time to do the research to see which one is better, and is then going to want to take the know how to download it, want to take the time to do all of that. It's all about convenience. And so, I mean, every person that buys a computer is not an MIT student. Every person that buys a computer is not even a Harvard student. You know, I mean, it's a big assumption to make that everyone is going to know exactly what they're doing and is going to want to buy the computer and download the software. It's a lot of time. You just want to buy your computer, open it up, and be able to click on Netscape, Internet Explorer, and be able to start. And that's one of the things that Microsoft was offering as a business is convenience, and that sells their product better. And there's nothing wrong with being a good business person.
I want to release our guests from the requirement of having to vouch for the fact that I'm actually reminded of my parents who are lawyers. In Pennsylvania, there's a rule that allows you, if you want to introduce a deposition, you can do a reading. You pick somebody just to read the text of the deposition in court. So my mom would be trying a case and actually invite my dad to play the doctor who had been previously deposed. And she'll ask him questions and he'll read the deposition and answer them right on the stand as if he's testifying. And they'll tell the jury beforehand that he's just playing a role. And one time this was done in a one-day trial, and after the trial, one of the jurors came up to him and said, my leg has been bothering me. I just love it. I just read something in today's Wall Street Journal. You might have read this. It's a little piece about Ed Felton at Princeton. For those of you who are following the case, he was the Princeton computer science professor who appeared as the government's expert witness. And he's actually teaching a course in Princeton where he's presenting the case. And they're explaining how he said he felt no compunction at all to try to fairly reflect the arguments of the Microsoft lawyers who were cross-examining him. So hopefully we did a little better than that. And I think your point was well taken. A lot of this case has been fairly bizarrely argued because predatory pricing is hard because so much of this software is offered free by all competitors at the same time. And you get into this weird, horses are being led to different kinds of water and you're seeing if they will drink behavior. And if we can just shove the software under someone's nose and we have a means of doing it through the operating system and control the desktop, how much of an absolute advantage is that? You have Bill Gates saying, hey, users aren't dumb. If Netscape is any better, they can go install it. And it's not answer questions. So why are you feeling like you have to, by contract, acquire the thing to be right front and center in the desktop? But surely there's a great power in the default. And that has been kind of central to figuring out how the case was unpacked. Why don't we take a couple more questions and then move to the next phase? So, yeah.
So let's get the mic. In response to the convenience argument, it seems like when Microsoft expounds on the virtues of simplifying the software, integrating it, giving us a uniform file format and all these things, they're not so much defending against an antitrust claim as they're saying maybe antitrust shouldn't apply here. It seems very much to me that they're in fact saying, yeah, we are squelching innovation. Innovation's a bad thing. It complicates things. It makes things difficult. And maybe, you know, a twisted analogy would be to say, you know, it's similar to saying, you know, well, if we got rid of patching and IC, then we wouldn't have to sit around and decide what kind of software they want.
Now, people don't worry so much about interoperability among colons, because there aren't a series of recipes for which your recipe is coded for one kind of cola versus another. It'll behave the same way, pretty much whatever you dump into a bowl. And in this case, you have this dynamic of network effects, which are at least a defense of natural monopoly here. It's saying, imagine the wonderful world of innovation and competition where pretty much at random you would get a differently configured keyboard for your computer. And it might be black, it might be QWERTY, it might be something else, and, you know, what a wonderful, diverse world. That's not. You want a world in which pretty much there's one keyboard that everyone uses, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's really a certain tension, there's an obvious tension between wanting uniformity and also wanting the ability to improve upon quality. And if Microsoft does give you this perfect package, you can't complain. If Microsoft gives you a package, and it's possible that there's something out there that could be better, and I think that's the question here. I mean, to what extent can innovation help? And it seems that Microsoft doesn't argue that they're not squelching innovation. They're sort of saying, yeah, we are, and thank us for it. I mean, I'll buy that, but I would also say that, you know, they're saying, they're channeling innovation, saying this is, you're going to get innovation, but you're going to get ours.
Yeah. Another step in the transformation of this class to Ricky Lake.
When listening to this, I get the sense that maybe what's going on here is that antitrust law itself is almost an antiquated way to deal with what Microsoft is doing. They've sort of found a way to do something that harms, that offends us, our intuitive sense of what should make a company successful. In the sense that, I mean, it's been said that Microsoft has become the biggest company, you know, ever, without really ever having designed a product that's truly creative or elegant in the way that we think of, you know, other great companies. And, you know, I get the sense that maybe, you know, Bill Gates, the thing that made him what he is his intuition that, you know, in the future, what will make a company rich is ubiquity rather than quality. And he saw that before I think a lot of other people did. And he was able to say, look, I got to get in front of these IBM guys and find a way to cheat my friend out of his operating system and sell it to IBM. And
he's been reading hard drive.
But the point is that he knew, you know, and that the future would belong to those who got the critical mass with their products. And it might not belong to people who would make a better product that didn't achieve that kind of critical mass. And so I think what offends us is this idea that he's found a way around our cherished values of, you know, the free market, in the sense that, you know, we believe that the best products should be the products that succeed. And I think that, you know, probably whenever the Sherman Act was passed, people started to look at the way the business world was working, and they said, you know, we need to make a law, because people are finding ways to get around what we think are, you know, our cherished values of the free market. So maybe essentially where we're at right now is another moment in history where someone figured out a way to be, you know, those same cherished values and get around them. So maybe there needs to be some other kind of law, like, you know, I don't know what you call it or how you design it, really, but it just seems like Microsoft has essentially created a new legal need.
Because the idea of gobbling the world is not new. It's certainly this Napoleonic thought. It's been the hallmark of business for a long time. I mean, so I don't know that it represents a whole shift in worldview, although I suppose people have different tools at their disposal with which to try to do it. I don't know how it would be.
Well, I think that even without my Microsoft hat on, I think that's a little bit of an unfair characterization. I mean, there really is a tremendous power in this integrated Windows suite. Where before Microsoft had any kind of leverage, came in and had a large impact compared to the other stuff that was out there. I mean, it's a little bit unfair to say that they haven't innovated anything or that the stuff is there, but merely what they've got is ubiquity. I mean, they've done that.
Well, if
if I might respond a little bit. I mean, I think that they've been able to, you know, hire the necessary people and, you know, to make a good product, you know, after the fact of establishing that kind of ubiquity. I mean, no one thought that the first Windows was very good, and yet everyone had to have it anyway. And, you know, suddenly Windows, well, it works okay. You know, it's not that bad. And yet, you know, you could sort of say, well, okay, they finally figured out how to be a really good company long after we already have to deal with them. I mean, I don't know. DOS wasn't something that appealed to me back when I had a Macintosh. It bothered me that it was doing as well as it was. And, you know, there were probably reasons that DOS did as well as it did. You know, it was competitively priced and everything. But I think ubiquity came before the creation of any kind of worthwhile product. But that's just my opinion.
So I want to recognize two in-room comments before we shift gears here. I see actually activity going on. I have them pop up on the screen. I could just read them aloud if that would make life easier. First, anonymously, why disrupt an obviously vibrant and fast-changing market for internet platform software before the DOS has even begun to sell? If we have faith in our antitrust department, why not wait until the damage, if any, is done, or at least knowable? Are there, in fact, dire consequences if Microsoft were to control the for-free browser market? I guess one answer to that, I was listening to NPR yesterday and was told that the State Department has two responses that it can alternate between for crises happening in the world. Response number one is too early to tell. Response number two is too late to do anything about it. And I think in some ways that's been the problem of the antitrust department as well. You don't want to intercede too early, or it just, you know, you're not sure if these practices, which you only know through objective manifestation, often in market movement, if they are the result of anti-competitive practices, and if so, if there were a major lawsuit or action to go after, then on the other hand, certainly in the fast-moving internet world, you're hit with, by the time you get to the bottom of it, certainly in the IBM antitrust case, it was a case in large part about punch cards, and long after the last punch card was punched, they were still trying to figure out whether IBM was cornering unfairly the punch card market for the machines that made it. So in that sense, it might prove a daunting
past for antitrust. Do you have any? Well, I confess the Microsoft argument when you point at things like the first PC launch, saying by the time any of this stuff is said, you know, you'll think of this stuff maybe like punch cards. It'll be a bit nothing. It'll be a whole different technology and a whole different set of players.
And the other remote comment that actually bears on this from Gavin says, well, with a sufficiently severe spanking, Microsoft might think twice about attempting similar behavior in the new space. So maybe it's a way of trying to set up norms so that eventually you'll pay, and as a result, you may seek to behave such as it is in the cutthroat competition for a new market. To be sure, Microsoft does not yet control Mr. Copy, which has a computer inside, but one day might. So I think it might be useful to show one more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think the whole issue is about software exploration. Not just you've got a platform, which you never have to install on the software. You just get the best, for the software. That platform is, especially the best part of this software, that's exactly what the internet is. Where in the future you may never have to install the software remotely.
And all you need is a browser to get to it, and browsers run on every platform.
Browsers run on every platform.
Right.
So essentially that's a pretty big threat, because that kind of platform where it's all going to come from the bottom up there, you don't have to install them. So the reason that Microsoft can be successful is because of the bottom, because it's so hard to install software, it is actually really a challenge for all kinds of people. And the internet and browsers are sort of market. That
but realize that your very point is predicated on the internet and the browser that connects one to it being an effective launching pad, a platform, if not an operating system, for getting to all these different pieces of software, which are then traditional operating system independent. And Microsoft says, okay, just as we knew that DOS's day was done, we weren't going to hang on to that monopoly for a while. It was just how to leverage into the new realm of graphical user interface. Here they may be thinking, you know, you're right. Windows is dead. It just doesn't know it yet. But guess what? The browser, as you say, is the window into the new software market, and if that browser can be Internet Explorer, we're back in the saddle again. We can make the browser not free forever. Maybe Internet Explorer Plus or Internet Explorer G2 will be the per-pay version, and you'll need that to really run spreadsheets with more than 5 cells in them. And we'll start it that way. I mean, it's a way of controlling it for which Java was the first element of this threat, and which they didn't defeat outright. They simply made Microsoft Java and made sure they had continued to proprietize whatever the central window on the software was going to be. Does that make sense? You've never encountered a website for which it doesn't work as well with Netscape as it does with Internet Explorer? The Berkman Center website, for example, was faced with a Falcon bargain. A new feature in Internet Explorer lets you, as the website author, specify a little icon that will appear in the bookmarks that drop down if somebody adds your page to bookmarks. And we had an internal debate within the Berkman Center as to whether we should make such a thing, because that's not part of the open source, open standard HTML that the World Wide Web Consortium does. It's an extra Internet Explorer feature that you're free to use or not as a website author. And if somebody's surfing, if you are using Internet Explorer, there's a little few little unbalanced scales that are really just meant to be 3D balance scale next to IS 99. That's an IS Internet Explorer feature. Yeah, that's great, you won't see it. Now, it's trivial, it's just an icon, but it's an example of the way that you can try to proprietize that which is open. And that actually might be a wonderful segue right into the next section of what we want to talk about. And that is, we have a world. It's a world that has some standards and some software open. Linux, a competing operating system to Windows, is at least more open than Windows is. You can get into the source and see it, and their license prevents you from doing that and perhaps generating derivative new work out of it if you make your own follow-on operating system. And indeed, the protocols of the Internet itself, as we've seen, are largely open. So anybody can sign up to write an email program, an email client that uses SMTP, Simple Mail Transfer Protocol, for which the standard is published and then developed within this patch of engineers in an open way, rather than we're just waiting for Microsoft to release SMTP version 3 or Service Pack 4. Says now, this is the law, this is how it would be laid down. And I guess the question, I mean, maybe I'd like to ask you, Hal, is so far we've been talking, to the extent we've talked about open versus closed models, about how they relate competitively to each other. Might open source software produce enough of a threat that that alone will neutralize the closed proprietary model of Windows software out of Microsoft? And which results in more efficient software or better software design? You know, Microsoft has the ability to say, here's our file format, we don't have to consult with a million people to make it, so we can get it out the door, versus the longer, more chaotic open process. But are there any other values, aside from pure efficiency, at stake that you see as to whether we should care whether most of the software that we run is open or closed?
Well, one obvious example is cryptographic software. Despite the fact that there are people who are releasing sort of closed source crypto programs, security experts basically think you'd be insane to put trust in a cryptographic program for which you couldn't see the source. And the reason for that is that if you can't tell whether it's actually giving you protection. So if you look at the output of some encrypted stack, it looks like some random garbage. And if it was some other crypto program in which somebody had biased it so there was that garbage, it would still look like random garbage. So the famous example of this is Netscape. In fact, when France was still doing domestic controls on cryptography, wanted to export its browser to France, and the French government made a deal with them, saying we will allow you to distribute Netscape in France, provided you agree to put in a back door for the French security system, so we can build stuff. And the Netscape people had this really easy answer. They said, this is dumb, because the SSL that's in Netscape is open source. So if we did put in a back door, every everyone would immediately see it, and it would be useless. And so in that sense, open source gives you a kind of, it gives you a kind of protection and a built-in protection against government regulation. Exactly, because it makes the stuff that you're relying on completely open and inspectable. And that's a totally different value from efficiency of developing stuff. Or whether,
is that a good thing or a bad thing?
That it's open and inspectable.
Now that you have built-in protection against government regulation. You see, among the lawyers, it's actually an open question.
Right. You did it at Harvard, MIT versus Harvard.
Oh, right. Yeah, when you guys weren't here last week, but last week we said some things that I assured the class would make the MIT students quite upset. Does anybody remember what the poll was about?
Harvard.
Yeah.
It's about the election on the left and having to...
Yeah, we were actually talking about that in your absence of IT people. We were deciding what would be a better thing if we could rewire the web such that before you signed on to it, you had to identify yourself, at least in a traceable way, such that if you did something bad with the right process, someone would be able to find you and know where you live. And the lawyers thought, at least half of them thought that was would make for a better web, right? How many of the MIT students are in favor of such a scheme? How many MIT students completely disavow such a scheme? All right, well, that's actually not as strong a position as I thought. So there's still something in the middle.
Can we first something that has to do with inspectable source for programs?
Well, it's interesting because you put it in two ways. First, you put it as kind of a truth in advertising way. If I want to buy food, it's one thing to tell me what the ingredients are. But here in the software realm, there's actually a way to subject the food to relatively easy molecular inspection. I can actually look to see if there's DHA and DHT added for freshness or not in this particular case. What's that?
Or hire someone you trust to do it.
That's true. I personally would not be in a position to do that. So that's right. So one benefit to open source software is that inspectability, and be particularly useful in crypto software, as you say, because you're buying it to obtain secrecy that you could only guarantee if you could see the code.
Right. You can't tell from the behavior whether it's working or not.
Right. But now, isn't that just a market push right there? I mean, if I'm in the market for crypto software, I'll just buy open code then, right?
Well, except if you're, in the example I gave, except if you happen to be in France, which was actually passing this regulation to do something surreptitious, so you actually didn't have a choice.
Hoping to kind of just sneak it in. Indeed, there was this fear recently, we think it's unfounded, that a tag was found in the Microsoft Windows.
Oh, yes.
Or NSA key, which people took to be National Security Agency key, and then immediately thought that all of Windows security was compromised to the U.S. government.
So that was just a little embarrassing event. It turns out not to be true. The reason that
the NSA key is named something completely different.
No, it's named NSA key for the NSA. And the reason it was named NSA key was the only reason they put that in is to allow the government to enforce export regulations. So they sort of said the only reason we're only putting in this key is some stupid regulation that has to do with the NSA, so they called it NSA key. So they got all of a stupid thing to probably a stupid thing to have named it, but it wasn't put in there for surreptitious purposes.
Is there any other reason why, I mean, suppose you're at a university and you're trying to figure out what code you want to be running to do your courseware. Is there a reason why you care whether it's open or closed? Microsoft Office, Microsoft Lectern seems to work pretty well.
Well, and that's a real, that's a career story, and this is actually a real issue for MIT, because I think as most of you know, we've entered into an agreement with Microsoft to do stuff for education, and while that's not only about developing educational software, we are going to develop some software, and then the question is, in a place like MIT, how should we be developing that? In a place like MIT, there are real constraints. You can't, if you're having students work on things, or even if you're having a lot of staff work on things, you can't start an environment where everybody is touching launching this thing has to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Generally, you can't enforce real constraints on people in the community because a university has to be an open environment. So I think in real practical terms, it's very, very hard to even develop stuff at a university that's not going to be, you know, if not totally full open source, new public license at the end, at least, you know, at least open in the sense that people have to look at it.
Is Microsoft sympathetic to this?
No, the Microsoft claims that they're not particularly in this to get products. What they really want is stuff that is going to be widely and publicly distributed. And I assume their model is, you know, the more there's great stuff going on for education, they can come in some other way to make sure that marketing wants.
So if a student in one of your classes knocks the homework assignment out of the park and actually devises a brilliant piece of software in answer to a question that has obvious market potential, does MIT have any claim on that software?
In that case, no. MIT, it's a little bit complicated. If the student is not funded to do that, that's absolutely completely belongs to students.
Now, Harvard may well have a different policy. I think they're still digesting it, but their policy may well be, if you do it for a class, it's ours as well as yours. Yeah.
Funded to do that work. So at MIT, the example would be if you're a graduate student and you're on a research assistantship, you're funded to do that work. If you're an undergraduate on a year off, it's a little bit present because then you can argue. But if you're just there and you do something, you know, by virtue of the fact you absorb all the brilliance from this environment and you did something, that MIT has no claim on that. And as Jonathan said, universities are starting to rethink that. And the reason they're starting to rethink that is they're starting to think of themselves as profit centers for all the great intellectual property that they did all, which is sort of a segue into the copyright information stuff we'll be talking about next week, but it's a very, very serious issue.
Yeah.
They have? I didn't know that. I'm on the committee that's supposed to make policy like that. I think that's a choice.
Are you happy about this new agreement? RBIA?
Well, let me sort of close the issue. It's sort of moving us from software, but I think it's something that all universities have to face down the road. And the question is the intellectual property that's developed at a university property of the university as an organization, really? So is a university a community that develops stuff? And then the university as a whole has an argument about how to put it out. Should we put it out for free or should we sell it? But it's the community itself that owns that stuff and makes those decisions. Or is the university kind of a guild of smart people, some of whom are, say, faculty members whose job is to go teach a couple of hours a week, and some of students who pay to hang around, and RAs who have very well-defined duties. But outside of that limited scope, everything they do is theirs. And that's a real hard choice, and I think all universities are going to be going through that in, probably in the next 10 years. It's going to be very, very, I think it's going to be very, very divisive, because you can make good arguments on both sides.
So can you think of any other reasons for us to care whether tomorrow's world is predominantly proprietized or predominantly open source? There's a sense of happenstance right now. Which chunks of it happen to be open and which chunks happen to be closed predominantly? Do we care how that line gets drawn? I mean, apart from the cryptographic example?
I think the cryptographic example is actually a very generalizable one. So again, if you believe the story of law and code, And to me, as a computer scientist, if you believe that code is sort of this thing that imposes real constraints like law, it's almost as if, now how would you feel if none of the laws were published? And it's just that someone comes along and says, oh, you violated law number 23. We're not going to tell you what it is, necessarily, but you ran afoul of it. And having to live in a world where you're constrained by things built into the software, but you don't actually have the ability or the right to find out really what's in the software sounds like a very, very funny world to live in.
It would be odd in the world of traditional law as we know it if occasionally a system bomb happened that just said, sorry, right? Occasionally you'd have blue lights behind you, you'd be pulled over, issued a ticket that says, please restart. Pay the ticket and now you just start again. And these would happen at odd intervals and you wouldn't quite know why and you'd have no means of saying, and that sounds like a bad world. This is Kafka-esque. And the strong version of the claim is, funny, that's the world we live in with code. Now, Microsoft, to the extent that you've got to buy Microsoft software, if you buy into Ben's introduction, and to the extent you don't know how software works, sometimes hands you flashing blue lights on a platter, exacts a penalty, and makes you restart. And you're not even sure why. And you might complain to them, and they'll say, thank you for your report on your helpline that costs $9 a minute. And, you know, maybe you made a response. Now, it's not to say that something like Microsoft could be completely arbitrary and capricious. Even a monopolist can overplay the hand, just like even a monopolist could overcharge at some point. There's still a market barrier to what would be done. And in that sense, Microsoft has to be responsive to you. But those kinds of barriers may be quite different than the barriers that a system of law, deeming community norms as subject to community deliberation and voting, rather than shareholder market voting, as a means of coming up with where the limits shall be. And I guess one way to think about it would be, think about a world in which every town is a company town. In fact, there's even competition among them, so you could choose what town to live in, and there'd be an antitrust commission above it all to make sure that in a given area, not every town was run by the same company. Now, what would that world look like? Would that be a world that would be bad? Would it be good? Would it resemble the one we're in now? In that town in which everything is privatized, including the provision of police services, presumably, as long as there was a consumer report that reported on these towns, ones that have flashing blue lights and pulled you over arbitrarily would become empty pretty quickly. Nobody would want to live there. So couldn't you, in fact, isn't the argument about the power of the market and the irrelevancy of the debate between closed and open code, because after all, the market will constrain the code to some reasonable modicum of what people want, doesn't that augur that we could even privatize all of government and just have a market response make sure the government is kept in line?
Give me trying that.
That seems a little goofy on first listen. And to transport it back and forth between real law and the code law that we keep saying are somehow equivalent, you know, depending on how well you really want to treat that equivalence, that helps you figure out whether the fact that most code is private code and most law is public law, it helps you see whether you mind or not. To me, a great case study. And I guess we need to learn more about it. It just happened this week. It couldn't have been better time, really, for this class. The IETF is now formally considering, as formal as they ever do anything, a request from the FBI to do CALEA, the equivalent of I want to be able to plug in and tap the network phone companies when I need to, says the FBI. They want to do that for internet protocol, so that internet packets can be plugged into as readily as a telephone network. And the IETF, which is the open process responsible for producing the packets, is trying to figure out how it should decide. So I don't know if you feel any better knowing that the debate will take place in the IETF, where you could all participate if you wanted. You could sign up on the mailing list. Or if that debate were happening, say, within Microsoft, where the NSA comes to Microsoft and says, please add the following key to your software.
But again, if you don't know, I mean, the internet is, people are only starting to realize the things that you can do on the internet. And if you can't look at the code, or if you can't hire somebody to look at the code, you know, it's often subtle things happen. So we're hearing, there's a nice example that Adam Clayton Powell referred to the other night. It turns out that if you use the internet in Tunisia, they have very good connectivity. You get to America online and all these places. If you happen to type in the address of Amnesty International, you get a web page that looks an awful lot like the Amnesty International web page.
And has a lot of news about it.
But you know, when you go find out what's in Tunisia, you have to have some problems, and it's really not so bad, but they're working on it. And I don't know if you noticed, I think there's some articles in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week about companies starting to do that. So if you're a company and you browse the website of some other company, you may not, if it sees you coming from the company or a site, you may not see the job ads. And all these funny things going on that people are realizing you can sort of surreptitiously do under the layer of where people are expecting to be open internet browsers. And you sort of have to ask, as code gets more and more and more closed, what's the check on that so people know that it's going on?
So aside from the market check on what makes code closed versus open, and those who traditionally do closed code are experimenting a little with open, and some of the people that usually do open are experimenting with closed, it's helpful to realize that what allows somebody to close her code completely often is law. It's intellectual property law. It's that law that says you can provide for licenses or even have a default arrangement by which to decompile your code and then make that available to the public to look at is a violation of copyright. So it's actually the government making an affirmative decision about how much to empower people to close their code. One way to close it would just be to try to lock it up so tight you just can't decompile it. But apart from that, kind of technological arms race, there's still this backstop of law. Because if you choose to proprietize, we let you do it. And how did that come about? Because computer programs were lumped in with literary works as things that are creative expression not to be copied if the person who authored it doesn't deem it should be for 95 years. It seems an odd way, again, to make the public policy decision about just how much closed versus open code to be one. Yeah.
Similarly along these lines, the other argument I guess we'll get to later in our class is over what's happening now with the NP3 standard and the music property rights and whatnot, where they're trying to make it illegal to make devices that will copy the music. So they're closing and going another layer deep. They're trying to control who can listen or read or see the material that's carried over this code.
Yes.
And having an open source mentality or culture actually prevents that from happening in the first place. I mean, Richard Salmon, who started a lot of this open source movement, has a very scary little futuristic style card piece about two college students who are afraid to read their homework assignments on each other's computers because it's illegal and they want to pay the royalty fee. There's a question of whether there's a slippery slope here in closing off control of the code.
And they had been trained to understand that it was bad, right, getting back to norms.
Yeah. Now, it also highlights, and among the readings for the law school side of things, there were some things about MP3 and SDMI and the Audio Home Recording Act. In addition then to traditional copyright protection, you have affirmative decisions, say, by the United States Congress in new laws that say anybody in the world that wants to make a music player has to make one such that if somebody says, don't copy this, the music player will refuse to copy it. Or in the case of digital audio tapes, when people were manufacturing digital audio tape players, fairly old technology by this point, it said, you can copy a digital audio tape, that if the stuff on the tape is so marked you can't copy a copy, you better not make a machine that will do that. Such a machine will be contraband and will be subject to seizure, and you can go to jail for a long time. So again, certainly government taking a side on the open versus closed debate in a way that the public at large is not well informed of the actual state. Any other thoughts? Chris? It might not be, but if you presume that the predominant standard and recorder from the market side of things, from the audio recording industry itself, is going to be closed code, if somebody actually undoes it to see what's inside to get around it, they are in violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. This act that says if you hack something for the purpose of undoing it and seeing how it works so you can copy something, you go to jail for a very long time. So you're right, if the predominant standard is an open one, such as MP3, the current standard, you don't worry as much, even if somebody tweaks it to make it unable to copy a copy later on. But there's a big question as to whether that would be the predominant standard even 6 months from now. Yeah.
I think it sounds like we're almost halfway into next week's session that has to do with trusted systems.
Yes.
So, indeed,
maybe some of the FDI stuff is not in your readings this week. So those of you who did the readings wondering what I'm talking about, you'll find it in fact it's in next week's readings. So if you've got next week's readings, which are now available at the distribution center, you'll know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, all will soon become clear. All right, I'll send an update to the law students about a whole bunch of things, including a review session. So we're going to open up the we'll meet in the executive forum
for the evening. The MIT students will do technology of trusted systems on Tuesday.
Yes.
We'll get back together here on Thursday to talk about policy.
Thank you. Thank you.